Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. We're talking about money and politics again and again. If this was a computer program, this would be extension 204 or iteration 299. But we're talking about money and politics again. Mike Costantino sitting across from me.
Yes, he is. Amazing.
Looking pretty spiffy this morning.
Sitting upright. Yeah. And he was sliding off the bar stool last night, but he's sitting upright this morning.
Ah, he looking good. And then Gary Lemaster, one of our producers, is here.
Good morning, everyone.
We're talking about money and politics.
Money and politics.
There are three new studies out.
And that's why we're talking about it. We realize, for those people that listen to Democratic Perspective regularly out there, mostly our relatives,
people we pay. The people,
they've heard this topic before and lots of times, but because there's three brand new studies.
All right. So let me run down the studies. The first study is just viral. It is all over the internet. Gary, you were saying this morning, this is the new Princeton study by Gillens and Page. And it's on all the left-wing blogs and all the right-wing blogs. And
when I went to look it up, I typed in the name of the study, and it popped up with hundreds of blogs from both the left and the right. Everybody is really upset. Everybody seems to agree with it, because I read quite a few of them.
On both sides.
On both sides. You know, it's one of the few things that there's some uniform belief in is that the economy is really out of whack, and the only thing that's different is how the two sides think we got here and their solutions for it.
John Cassidy, in the writing in the New Yorker, is kind of cute. He calls the study as being from the Department of Academics, confirming something that you already suspected.
Well, that's
which
it. Which
is that the policies of the United States, and they studied, 1,776 different policies, are controlled largely by the very rich and by business interests. This is the first study we're going to talk about. The second study is sort of almost equally interesting, and that is that, you know, Mike and Gary and I think many of our listeners are of an age where the United States was always the wealthiest country in the world, but also the American middle class was the most successful and wealthiest middle class in the world. So when what's happened is there's a lot of new social scientists, and they're looking at things in much more detail. And one of the things they looked at about the middle class, and they said, well, how is the middle class doing in these different countries? And the conclusion is that the Canadian middle class is now better off than the American middle class, and some of these other middle class in Sweden and so forth are accelerating. So if you look at the whole picture, because the American super wealthy are making so much money and increasing their wealth, it looks like we're making huge progress.
It's not because it's because of policy. It's because of their influence on policy. In other words, the American middle class isn't doing well because of the wealthy's influence on those 1,700 policies you just talked about. That's the we're going to keep reverting here to definition, because for a lot of people the financial discussions are what we're talking about. Oligarchy, the vocabulary word for the day is oligarchy. In other words, where a country is run by the wealthy individuals who want their policies furthered, and wealthy businesses who have lots of money to spend who want their policies implemented.
And this debate and discussion actually goes back to the founding fathers, where James Madison had a long discussion of there's the democracy where we all get out and vote, and there's democracy of all the details of the American government. But then there's a question of the underlying structure, the non-formal structure, who runs what. The third study, and then I'll kind of turn it over to these guys. The third study is not as important, but it's interesting. And it's all these studies, I think, folks, if you look at your friends around you, if you look at your own experience, you're going to find that although they're academic, they're just massive amounts of information supporting stuff that's pretty clear. And the third study is that we've made up all the jobs that we lost during the Great Recession, made them all up, but the middle income and higher income jobs have been lost, and they've been replaced by low-income jobs, low-paying jobs,
and
systematically.
Right? And the young people are having a great deal of difficulty, especially college graduates that are coming out with large amounts of debt, and they're having a real tough time finding jobs. You know?
And if you go into your fast food places, you'll notice that a lot of older folks are working there. There's no longer jobs just for young people starting out. Most of the, I believe the majority, Mike, of 57% of the fast food workers are now over 30 or 40.
Yeah. Right? That's an intentional strategy, though. McDonald's, I did some work with, back when in the 80s, they were already, looking at seniors to take over a lot of the jobs. So they actually went out and recruited them.
So the newest studies show that it's the wealthy and business groups, organized business groups, that control how policies are decided.
Yeah.
The second study shows that the middle class, our middle class, the median income people are falling behind other countries, while our wealthy are accelerating the difference between the wealthy here and in most large countries.
We're number one with billionaires.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's the worst impact, I think.
So does everybody understand? If we throw the whole economy in, then we're doing a lot better than other countries, or doing somewhat better than other countries. If we actually look how the middle class and the poor, quadrants are doing, or percentiles are doing, then we're not doing nearly as well.
Yeah.
And there's a beautiful new chart. Of course, we can't show you all these charts and graphs that were in the New Yorker from that study.
And that's why we're having this discussion this morning.
So what's an oligarchy?
Well, it's exactly what we've been, according to the definition I have, the star next to here, it's a, the two creators of the Princeton study call the state of current political system economic elite domination. Another term that could be used is oligarchy or oligarchy, otherwise known as a system in which power rests with a small number of economically or politically advantaged people. And then they make comparisons to the Gilded Age, and everybody, well, okay, what's that? At the beginning part of the last century, the J.P. Morgans and the Roosevelts and the robber barons of old that ran the country. For a lot of people, this discussion is a duh report. I saw that in a magazine called Death and Taxes magazine. A lady named Robin Pinchia, she said, this is a duh report. Maybe America should just accept their fate. I mean, the fact that rich people run the world is not exactly a huge revelation. I remember when I saw this on my Facebook page, I put no crap, but I didn't, I said it in a different way. I said, gee, this is not exactly news. This is not a stop the presses moment that rich people are running the world.
What it is they've been able to quantify it and study it in more detail than ever before. But
that's it.
But Mike is right. I mean, I don't think any of us are surprised at the influence. And these scientists, social scientists, have tried to measure the exact nature and quantity of the social science. The other thing Mike is referring to, the Gilded Age was really before Teddy Roosevelt starts jumbling things up and before populism gets going in the United States. And the distribution of wealth now between the very top 10%, the top 1%, is now approaching the Gilded Age. Before all the reform of Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt, before all the wars and stuff, we're returning to the income distribution that's much like all before all this happened.
And yeah. If you look at the reasons for it, these studies often don't try to explain how we got there.
They don't.
They look in great depth at where we're at. But if you look at the reasons for it, I just have a few statistics that according to the Center for Responsive Politics, in 1998, $1.45 billion was spent on lobbying in Congress. In 2013, that number had more than doubled to $3.2 billion. In 98, there were 10,406 registered lobbyists. In 2013, there were over 12,000. And that doesn't even, you know, include the people that are working to lobby Congress that haven't even bothered to register.
There's a whole new group that don't call themselves lobbyists, but basically are effectively lobbyists. So what we've been talking about for years is the kind of statistics that Gary is talking about here. And you'd think with all that money pouring into politics and all those lobbyists, it would influence things. And sure enough,
yeah, it does.
But there's good social science and bad social science. And one of them, I don't want to go down on this, criticizing the road of criticizing this guy too much. But one study, one social scientist, and this has happened quite a few years ago, his way of studying the influence of lobbyists was to go and ask the lobbyist and then go ask the congressional representatives if the lobbying had any effect on them. And the lobbyist said, no, we don't really not, you know, we don't really get our way most of the time. Everything is fine. And the congressional representative said, no, we're not influenced by giving $100,000. Doesn't affect what we do at all. So that's one kind of social study. And I think it's an interesting one. And at least it got, the justification, I guess, that you see for the mess in Washington.
This study kind of lays waste to that idea that they don't have any impact, because the Gillens and Page study actually shows what happens when citizens prefer a bill. It seldom gets passed. When the elites prefer something, it almost always gets passed. If both of them align, then it's almost certain to get passed.
The probability of a policy change for if the mass of people are for it, but the elite is against it is 0.3% or 3%.
Wow.
Whether it's a tiny minority or a large majority of what average citizens favor as a policy, if the elite and the money is on the other side, it just does not happen. So there are the things that happened. I mean, we have a lobbying group and they get a bill through that advantages their industry, but there's also the things that don't happen. And so what Gillens is saying is, and then giving him a little quote, Gillens and Page, I had his name wrong, the second author's name wrong. Americans do enjoy many features central to democratic governance, such as regular elections, freedom of speech and association, and a widespread, if still contested, franchise of what to be able to do. What's happened is that the policy making is now dominated largely by elite groups, highly organized. Mass organizations don't have much effect on politics. What Gillens and Page found was that the people who have effect are the very, very wealthy and business organized groups.
Since the right always accuses the left of being elitist, I find it necessary to define what we're talking about with the term elite. The elitists that, you know, when they accuse the left of being elitist, it's because of academics. It's because of education. What we're talking about here are people that have extreme amounts of wealth that are, you know, elite because of their wealth.
Real elitists.
And then Learjet
elitists.
And then the multinational corporations. Those are the elites that are influencing.
And they're lobbying in organizations. So the Chamber of Commerce, the National Chamber of Commerce, not the local Chamber of Commerce. The National Chamber of Commerce is a good example of this. What they found was, of course, that the unions are very weak. The mass organizations trying to do something are very weak. Sometimes the elite wants to do sort of liberal things, and mostly they want to do very, very conservative economic things. So the business elite, and you, if you listen to them, they don't want a big, they think immigration's a good thing. It brings prosperity to the country. They don't want a big fight about immigration. They don't want a big fight about gay rights. They want gay employees. They want gay folks buying their products. So in that, they differ, it's to some extent from more conservative American. But everything else, except for a few cultural things, is almost always decided by elite groups and stuff. And Gary, you want to talk a little bit about, you know, the different pictures of how the U.S. works, the different terms that they use.
The theories?
The different theories. Cause, and as we'll just do this shortly, because I know this is kind of heavy academic lifting, but people have been thinking about this stuff for a long time. And, as I mentioned, Madison was the first guy to really write about it. He based a lot of his stuff on Aristotle. But go ahead.
Yeah, those guys.
Yeah, those guys.
I want to say this is why the study is important. What Gary's about to read here is because of these details. In other words, it detailed the extent of what we already pretty much knew, at least what we already felt. When you read your 3% figure, that when people want a policy, when there's a majority of people that want something, it has slight chance of getting through.
That's right. To be exact, I think Mike is right. It has no chance. It has a slight chance.
And these studies are documenting that.
And understand that, say you're really a conservative and you want to cut taxes on the very wealthy, and Congress cuts taxes on the very wealthy. You may think that you influence that, but it's the very, very wealthy who have organized having that done. So whatever ordinary people think happens, a lot of the time, or a part of the time, it's not necessarily because you've had much influence. It's because somebody else has had influence, and you agree with where they're going.
It happens most of the time, according to the studies. There's really four traditional theories of how U.S. politics works, going back, as Steve said, to the framers. The first one is the thought that we're controlled by a majoritarian electoral democracy, that we're, it's all about freedom and democracy. It's best encapsulated by Abraham Lincoln's reference to government as of the people, by the people, for the people.
That's the ideal, right, Mike?
Yeah, that was my new vocabulary word for majoritarian. That was my vocabulary word for today.
Majority of the people. The government is of the people, by the people, and for the people. And I think Gary's right, that is the best formulation of the best picture of American
government. And that's how we'd like to think the government works. And as part of that theory is the two-party system, where you have two vote-seeking parties that the theory is that if they both take the same position, then everybody will move to the center. They'll both parties will move to try to pander to the voters.
To win elections, both parties, the theory is that both parties move to the center.
And that's important because this is the way it used to be.
And
most of us say, well, I don't get involved in politics.
You could
focus on your life. You went on and on because this is the way it used to be. Either party would come to a reasonable conclusion. That is not so anymore. There is only one reasonable party. The other side is nuts.
Okay, Gary.
And number two is kind of what we've been talking about.
I don't disagree, Mike.
Nor do I. But number two is kind of what we've been talking about. It's the economic elite domination. And this is the theory that that only people with wealth and power run the country. And some have even, historians looking back on the founding of the country, actually believe that the framers, really one of their main interests was, to protect private property, favoring the economic interests of wealthy merchants and plantation owners rather than the interests of, the then majority small farmers, laborers, and craft workers. And you can kind of see this with the votes regarding slavery, where they wanted to count the African American slaves as 3/5 of a person. And in order to give power to distribute power to the South.
People who were completely not slaves, not allowed to vote ever or even learn to read, were counted for the purposes of political power in the original framing of the Constitution.
Well, we saw that over and over. American at the time of Lincoln knew slavery was wrong, but economic interest trumped morality, as it always does and continues to do.
Number three is the study refers to as majoritarian pluralism. And this is the theory that the majority will always rule. That it goes back to, as Steve mentioned earlier, it goes back to James Madison's Federalist Paper number 10, which analyzed politics in terms of factions. He argued that the struggles among the diverse factions that would be found in an extensive republic would lead to policies more or less representative of the needs and interests of the citizenry as a whole.
So after World War II, the unions are very strong, business is very strong, and they're kind of, what they call them, countervailing powers. They struggled, and they came up with the policies that emerged from before and during World War II that led to a huge prosperity between the 1940s and the 1970s. And that collapses in the 70s, some people think in the early 80s.
But I believe what Gary's going to read next is where we are at the moment.
This is what I've thought for a long time. Having been a small businessman, and seeing that I was subsidizing large corporations, I felt this for many, many years. It's called bias pluralism. And the thought is that this theory is that business-oriented interest groups tend to prevail over ordinary citizens when their scope is narrow and visibility is low. In other words, you know, they kind of fly under the radar. People don't think too much about what the large business interests want, but in most cases they get what they want. And you know, it kind of goes back to, you mentioned the Chamber of Commerce, Steve. You know, the Chamber of Commerce, I used to be a member of it. They never represented small businesses. They claim to, but the organization politically at the top spends all of their money representing the largest corporations in the world.
In fact, if you're somebody like the Koch brothers, and you're producing a whole lot of extractive energy and creating a whole lot of pollution, you can really buy a chunk of the chamber to lobby for you. You can really wash your money by giving it to the chamber so it can't be traced, and then the chamber will basically do what you want done. As Gary says, you are a very, very large and powerful corporation. It's not going to do it if you're a mom-and-pop grocery store.
If you look at the studies of attitudes by small business groups, they run almost entirely counter to what the Chamber of Commerce represents or claims to represent. Yeah, so.
The NRA is an example, a little bit. And one of the things I don't think that these fellows addressed is sort of mixed groups, where you have a populist organization like the NRA, plus you have the gun manufacturers pouring a whole bunch of money in it, and the people who retail guns pouring money into it. So you have a combination of a business lobby and a populist lobby based on certain ideas.
Yeah. Yeah,
and so there are exceptions, and none of the studies are perfect, and we're always learning, and it's a dialogue, and we're bringing you a dialogue that's going on between a lot of the academics folks who are doing deep research. What's happened now, and we'll be talking about it again next week, is that computers are able to crunch tremendous amount of data to back up and to examine assumptions that we couldn't do before. Massive amounts of information. Also, we're in the beginning of the 21st century, and good data, good information about, say, the income people had, the distribution of wealth, has been around for a longer period of time. And so it makes it easier to get a clearer idea of what's going on.
And they're finding new ways to look back into history. You know, this study was based on looking at tax returns. You know, the governments didn't track a lot of, there weren't a lot of studies on wealth distribution.
Right.
For example, but, But they all took really good records on tax returns.
All these new groups that don't really take positions. They don't take policy position. They just collect and store and will deliver to you data so you can help figure things out.
So what are we going to do? I'm going to read a couple quotes from, here's one from Counterpunch magazine. The American democracy is a sham no matter how much it's pumped up by the oligarchs. The oligarchs run the country and who also control the news media. And for me, this is a big deal. It's one thing to say, okay, that the wealthy 1% run the country. You know, they have this huge influence on the Bushes and the Clintons and everybody else who's running the show. But when we lost the media is when things really got bad. He writes, this is a guy named Eric Zeiss.
This is the view of the left. I mean, looking at these, one view from the left, looking at the same data. He really thinks...
You want to argue that the nation's media is not controlled?
I would say, Mike, there's more variation in it. I think that's too absolute a formulation of this. There's, you know, if that was true, there would be no Elizabeth Warren.
That's true. What they say about liberals, they're incredibly naive.
Yeah. No. If that was true, there would be no Elizabeth Warren in the Senate. Now, there are not a lot of Elizabeth Warren, so it's kind of true, or partly true, or mostly true, but it's not completely true. That's my personal take on it.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. You can be wrong on the air. The U.S., in other words, is basically similar. This is the same guy speaking, same magazine. The U.S. is basically similar to Russia and most other dubious electoral democratic countries. We weren't formally, but we clearly aren't now. And then, like I said, this is a duh report, but I didn't get to her quote. Perhaps we ought to suck it up, said the lady in Death and Taxes magazine, Robin. Perhaps we ought to suck it up and admit we have a classist society and do like England, where we have a House of Lords and a House of Commoners, instead of pretending as though we have some kind of equal opportunity here.
So we have a new, you know, 10%.
Well, it doesn't,
a Senate of the 10%, they can elect
much
themselves.
To think of the U.S. Senate as a House of Lords. It doesn't take much to think of the U.S. Congress, the
House
of
Lords. I think there's a gradient between the United States, which still has fairly strong democratic institution, even though they've been distorted by the kinds of processes we're talking about, and some place like Russia, which under Putin has been pushed further and further to even more dubious elections and so forth and so on. And everybody knows that the world is filled with countries that are theoretically democracies, and sometimes they are and sometimes they aren't. And it's hard to judge. You know, some of these South American countries seem to have pretty free elections, and they elect people.
Putin,
and some of the others are completely rigged.
But we have Jamie Dimon.
When you look at the House of Lords, you know, Mike's comment is, and compare it to the U.S. Senate, the statistics for 2012 is that it cost $10.4 million on average to get elected to the U.S. Senate.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, to me, that is a House of Lords. You know, it's you need major money.
Well, yes, and that is the problem of money in politics. You need $10 million to win an election, and you can get it from small contributors, which if very, very, very hard to do, or you can get it from larger contributors.
And you can't get it from small. I take exception with that too this morning, Steve.
Well,
you can't get it from small contributors. You can try, and a few politicians are successful at getting the same kind of money from many contributors. But the Sheldon Adelsons and the others that contribute, you know, $94 million, what 4%, and only 4% of us. I know when my daughter gets something in the mail asking for money, she resents it. She thinks political naivete, like a lot of people, she doesn't believe that money, that they shouldn't be asking her for money.
Right.
The other side, of course, thrives on money.
You're right. We're heading for a system where, you know, 100,000 of us can give $25, and we've got billionaires who can you know, outspend his members. One of the things was, there was a study, a little bit dubious, and it said basically the unions spend more money than the Koch brothers. Well,
not even close.
There are two Koch brothers, and there's like, you know, 80 million people in this union. And so it's comparing two guys to however many million people it is.
And you have
it's
to
not
look
a
at
fair
how,
comparison.
You have to look at how they spend their money in politics, and it's a, you know, it's a very different thing. The study actually shows that the unions are very ineffective with lobbying Congress.
Yeah.
And that's where most of the union money gets spent.
The mass organizations like the unions are very ineffective in terms of determining policy. And these guys are studying determining policy, not just broader things, but determining policy. Wow. If you can determine policy, you can determine an awful lot.
If you look at the presidential election in 2012, President Obama, got a huge number of individual, people contributing to his campaign. Yet, $5 to $30, contributions.
Yeah. Our level.
Vastly more than the other side. The thing is that even with that, the vast majority of the money that was spent to elect Obama came from large.
Yeah, he still had to go to wealthy contributors.
And I say,
everybody does sooner or later, but I do think there are differences. That's what
I'm going to try to say it every show. You work your whole life for $2 million. You spend your whole life, your whole working life. If you work from the time you're 20 to the time you're 60, if you work for 40 years and you make 50 grand a year, guys, I'm no mathematician. And that's 50 grand a year, which around here is a top salary.
Around here, 50
exactly,
grand a year.
Especially at 20 years old.
It's like being in the top 1%.
You're top 1%. But for numbers purposes, 40 years at 50 grand a year, you work your whole life for $2 million. These guys spend this on lunch.
Talking about guys that are spending billions to
apparently they're worth $100 billion now.
A good bottle of wine.
An article, I think it was a business magazine. They're topping $100 billion. If we keep having almost no taxes on the wealthy and how they get their money, they're going to have more and more power. Money is going to be translated into power. And many of us don't really, I don't think any of us really tried to ever get super rich except for Gary. And
failed.
But it's not so much that the wealth bothers. It's the way they're using their wealth to distort the American system, to undercut other people, to cut down on food stamps, to cut down on unemployment, cut down on school lunches. They're using their billions of dollars to hurt ordinary Americans and to take control over our politics all the propaganda.
Let's talk about specifics here. We got Gary's got all this Gallup poll information where it was exactly what we're talking about this morning, where the majority of people. American people believe one way and these policies never get, abortion. Only 20% think abortion should be illegal, according to the Gallup poll. 26% think it should be legal under any circumstances, and 52% think it should be legal only certain circumstances. So this whole war against, this health policy for women, is counter to what American people think. Contraception. 89% favor contraception. 61% think it should be covered by insurance. 64% believe gay marriage should be legal. 31% disagree. Public schools. 86% of American people enroll their children in public schools, according to the Gallup polls. Equal pay, which is in the news right now. 84% favor the Paycheck Fairness Act. And this is a hard one not to to endorse. I mean, why would you not endorse Paycheck Fairness?
I think, one of the things that the authors of the Gillens makes the study of is that a lot of the study of power in the United States during the Cold War, people really pulled their punches because the United States was competing with the Soviet Union, and it was considered unpatriotic to actually talk about the power elites and how things
were
actually happening.
That,
it was considered unpatriotic, and it still is.
Today.
I mean, people do it. The other thing
go to a Chamber of Commerce meeting and have this kind of I don't care whether it's a Cottonwood Chamber or Sedona Chamber. You'll be alone in a heartbeat.
Yeah, when people tried to explain what was happening until the end of the Cold War, which I guess the Soviet Union collapsed in, what, 91? Something like that.
89 when the wall came.
Gorbachev actually approached, it wasn't so much a collapse, it was Gorbachev made an offer to Reagan in 89.
The other thing is that Americans are unwilling to look what's happening or what middle class people get in the rest of the industrialized world. All right. And take example, it's not just Sweden, it's almost everywhere in Europe. And certainly anybody who works in the tourist industry knows some of this stuff. They get 5 weeks of vacation a year. They get comprehensive health benefits. They get almost 3 years between the father and the mother to off paid to raise their kids, to get their kids going. They have a subsidized child care center, and all of it costs about 3% of their income. So in some ways they have, in Sweden the middle class still has less money than we do, but they have all these sort of benefits. And Americans, I think, are patriotically refusing to look at how bad our healthcare system is in terms of delivering stuff. Obamacare is helping some, but it's not really a solution to the basic overcharges that are everywhere.
And I'd say that every time the public starts to focus on these things too much in the U.S., we start waving the flag and involve ourselves in another war. You know, so suddenly it distracts you from the reality of what's going on.
Well, that is it. It's just not American. I left off of my list the biggest policy that people support that isn't going anywhere, and that is background checks for guns. I mean, you have 90% of people want background. 90% want, according to Gallup poll, want background checks. They don't necessarily agree on gun control, but 90% say, you know, a background check's a good idea before you give someone a gun. And we can't even get that passed.
The same is true with the minimum wage bill.
Huge support.
It has 73%. Think the federal minimum wage should be raised to $10.10.
And what the conservative is going to say, if we raise the minimum wage, businesses are going to cut jobs.
But if
we raise the thing, and I think that when we had one of the economists here, he said like $17 an hour would be a minimum wage. If we do that, some businesses will cut jobs, except that everybody who's working for $7 and some 80 cents an hour will suddenly be making $17 an hour. They'll have more free money. They'll buy more stuff. It'll create more jobs. And it'll redistribute the income in a way that's fair. So I think one of the things we can do is increase the minimum wage substantially. And the president is talking about 10.10 an hour. That's still not really enough to support people.
But it's more realistic than your 17.
Yeah. They did a study, and the auto workers back in the 60s and 70s made, in today's dollars, $50 an hour. And that's why if you were an auto worker, you could put your kids through college, you could buy a house, you could buy two cars.
On one income.
Oh, and the majority of Americans, Bill Maher's got a great quote going all over the internet. The majority of Americans work for GM, making exactly what you said, the equivalent in today's dollars of $50 an hour. Today, the majority of workers work at Walmart, making $8 an hour and living on food stamps.
And so what we've talked about so often, folks, is the collapse of the middle class. And what these studies are showing is just that.
But Alice Walton built a great big art museum in Bentonville, Arkansas.
Well, good for her. It's not that the wealthy don't do a whole lot of stuff. Great stuff to charities and so forth and so on. And there are people like Warren Buffett who are giving away most of their fortune. Gates, several other people. It's not that they don't do a lot of wonderful stuff. It's that it's not good to concentrate. America is not going to work. All our systems of voting and stuff are not going to work if all the money gets increasingly concentrated at the top. It's going to give them too much influence. If you want them to have all the money and don't want to tax them, then you have to get their money out of politics. There's two choices. You can either tax it, get a fairer redistribution of the income, or you can force money out of politics.
Are you purposefully giving me a segue into my favorite, my Clean by 19 program that I think you're going to be hearing lots about? We interviewed a gentleman here a couple weeks ago, Jim Pilaro, who has this impossible dream. You talk about Don Quixote, you know, on the horseback, and I want to be his Sancho Panza. The sidekick, because I think getting money out of, and short, long story short, two constitutional amendments, one national, one state, that calls for public funding of all elections, period.
You also have to deal with lobbying, too.
Yeah,
we have to deal with
the
lobbying.
The massive amount of lobbying. We've studied that many times. We should talk again about lobbying. So what these studies show, again, is that it looks like all this money is being spent is having an effect. And, yeah, it's having an effect. The people who are spending the most money are, by and large, winning the most battles. Does not always happen. It's not always the largest contributor. If there's a fight, say, between two industries, say the oil industry and the solar industry, it's not always the guys who put in the most money that win the policy fight.
All right, but it is always about time. When you're spending 70, 60, 70, 80% of your time raising money, and I don't care whether it's from unions or whether it's from Sheldon Adelson or whether it's from the 1% we're talking about, you are not doing the people's business. And that's everything from a city council election, where if you're going to be serious, I witnessed as a reporter many city council elections where people didn't raise any money because it was a nonpartisan city council, whether it was Sedona, whether it was Cottonwood, whether it was Camp Verde. You ran, you got coverage in the local press, and you talked to every friend you ever had, and you ran for council. Now you better be doing some fundraising for local elections.
I think one of the sad things about this whole topic of oligarchy is that the general public, I think, tends to believe that the uber rich, the 1%, made their money by being smart and by working hard. And the reality is that that's not the case. There's a heck of a lot of luck involved, primarily to which parents they were born. And secondly, you know, they have rigged the system to, you know, keep their money. And so they keep building more and more wealth. And it's, they use this whole personal responsibility thing against us.
Yeah. Mike.
Yes.
We got an announcements?
We do.
We have at least one announcement. Right?
Yeah, well, we have at least one announcement. But we want to thank Democrats of the Red Rocks, and they have their wonderful movies at the Sedona Library every month.
Free.
They are free. We want to put that printed in red right here. The free May movie is Gasland Part 2. In this explosive follow-up to his Oscar-nominated film Gasland, filmmaker Josh Fox uses his trademark dark humor to take a deeper, broader look at the dangers of hydraulic fracturing, or fracking as it's called, the controversial method of extracting natural gas and oil now occurring on a global level in 32 countries worldwide. Gasland Part 2 is what we're going to be looking at. We're going to be looking at it on May 29th at 6 p.m. at the Sedona Library. Admission is free, and there's rumors that I may lead the discussion.
There is a rumor that you may lead
after
the discussion.
After
I think
movie.
It's a fearful idea.
Are you going to light water on fire?
Possible. The movie in June is called Damnation, and it's about all the dams that were built all over the United States that are now aging, and some of them collapsing, being undercut. We just built dams, and we didn't think about the environmental impact of them. We just built and built and built. But that was, the country was younger. So this is a movie about the impact of that. We'll be showing that in June. I don't have a date for it to give out to you folks.
We need to mention also that one of our sponsors is Democrats of the Verde Valley.
That is true.
Absolutely.
We do want to thank Democrats of the Verde Valley.
Yes, we do.
Stalwart group.
Right, as long as our little brothers to the south there, as long as they and I hope they get it together. This show and all shows can be found on VVID. We have a great website, where Gary summarizes all of these incredible brilliance you've just heard for the last 45 minutes on vv.org. We have summaries printed, if you like that, and we also have every recording we've ever done, which, by the way, I'd like to remove some because of the because they weren't exactly stellar. But let's vvid.org, Democratic Perspective. And that's
and podcasts else? Are just like listening to the radio. You can you can put them on and do something else while you're listening.
You'll find a lot on money and politics.
A lot of money in politics. For sure. Thank you, folks.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.